This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
I'm very pleased to welcome Ray Grass back to Dreamland after two long a hiatus. Ray, it has been 10 years since
longer
you were on
than that,
this.
Actually.
Well, no, 10 years since you were on Dreamland. I thought I just looked at the dates.
Perhaps you're probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. And in any case, I was astonished because I thought you were a frequent guest and you haven't been. Anyway, folks, my fault and my loss and our loss. Ray is a teacher. He is a photographer. He was once an artist, but should have continued, in my opinion. He is an astrologer, an extraordinary astrologer. I say on one of the covers of one of his books, Ray Grass is one of the world's greatest astrologers, and I think that's true. He is the author of a number of books, An Infinity of Gods, Stargates, The Waking Dream, which Colin Wilson called a masterpiece, and I would agree. He's worked for Quest Magazine, Quest Books. He's been an associate editor of the Mountain Astrologer for 20 years. He graduated from the Art Institute of Chicago, where he studied filmmaking and painting, and I think you had a much more interesting experience at the Art Institute of Chicago with filmmaking. And we'll get into all of this. And also, in the last half hour of the show, we're going to be talking about astrological conditions on planet Earth right now. Where are we astrologically, and where might we be going? What do the stars tell us about planet Earth? Ray, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to see you.
Well, it's nice to see you too. And thank you so much for The Sky Stretched Out Before Me, which came, I didn't even know it had been published, and it came with a lovely, little card and a note from Ray. And I was just entranced by it. I want to start out with filmmaking. Stan Brakhage, who was your teacher, and Kenneth Anger, who you knew and had an unusual experience with, to say the least. I never knew Anger, but I was in his orbit a couple of times in my life, would be the best way to describe it. Tell us a little bit about Kenneth and your experience with him when you went to his house.
No, I never went to his house. He came to the school at the Art Institute several times.
When a guest showed up.
Oh, that's Stan Brakhage's story.
Did I say Kenneth? I'm sorry.
Stan and Kenneth together.
Yeah.
It was a story that Stan related to me that was quite interesting. Which I can relate. Do you want me to tell that story?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, of course.
Stan himself, I should say a few words about Stan first to give a sense of context here. Stan Brakhage isn't well known to the mainstream, I suppose, but in the avant-garde cinema world, he was very well known as a experimental filmmaker, and he was close friends with people like Kenneth Anger and Allen Ginsberg and many others, Andy Warhol. And he told the story. Kenneth did come to school several times, and he was a fascinating character, still alive, I believe, in his 90s, an experimental filmmaker, and worked with people like Jimmy Page and the Rolling Stones and all that. But Stan went to Kenneth's house once back in, I think it was L.A., and Kenneth was, as you know, involved with magic very heavily.
Yes.
And Stan wasn't really interested, but he was curious. And Stan said, we'll show you some of the basics and we'll teach you something about what we do, him and his friends. And so they invited Stan to come to Kenneth's house. And they sat Stan down and started teaching him about some of the basics of magic, high magic. And a friend of theirs came to the door that they weren't expecting and kind of ruined the mood, and they didn't know what to do because he wasn't invited. So according to Stan, Kenneth walked to the other side of the kitchen behind the newcomer that had just walked in the house sitting at the kitchen table and did a gesture in the air with his hand and turned on the stove aflame, at which point the fellow that had walked in unexpectedly, his head drooped in mid-sentence. And then at the end of the evening, after Kenneth had taught Stan some of the basics, Kenneth walked back to the stove, turned on the stove, and did another gesture with his hand, and the fellow, the newcomer, picked up his head and continued in mid-sentence, had no idea what had happened to him, had obviously a missing time experience there. So these were very interesting individuals. And Kenneth, the times I met him, he seemed like a very kind man, a gentle fellow. But again, he, like his hero, Aleister Crowley, had this double-edged sort of side to his personality that either drew people in or pushed people away. So that's that story.
Well, the story interested me for a number of reasons. The last time I had a missing time experience was a week ago Monday. I had just finished the Making Contact conference, and I had at least 4 hours lost during that day, that Monday. And previously, I had about a month before or 6 weeks before at this point, I had had a meeting with Mark Sims and Danny Sheehan. And before that meeting, I had 24 minutes of missing time. So missing time is a big part of my life. I've had a lot of missing time, and it's something that happens quite frequently now. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think could be going on? Because I had always thought it was something kind of technological, maybe a sound or something, or some kind of hypnotic suggestion. But I wonder if it could be accomplished by magic.
Oh, I absolutely think that's true. I think the story of Kenneth and Stan kind of bears that out. Now, there was technological to the degree that Kenneth turned on the stove and turned off the stove.
That's the thing that I just blew my mind, because what is so strange about it is that I'm often standing in the kitchen when it happens here. And of course, the stove is a gas stove in the kitchen. And I just was brain bent. I couldn't. It's like it was like slipping into another reality all of a sudden. And I do not see the people or whatever it is who comes in here. I'm having a lot of trouble. I would like to find some hypnotist who could do it, but I've just got so much baggage. I was successfully hypnotized years and years ago by Don Klein, the psychiatrist. I had no baggage then. Now I'm loaded with baggage. Anybody who comes to hypnotize me is hypnotizing Whitley Strieber. And Whitley Strieber is very well aware of Whitley Strieber too. And you put all of that together and you've got a situation where it's going to take a real master not to create a compliance scenario, or have us both begin to become mired down in expectations. So I can't see how I can find out, and I guess it's impossible.
I do think it's possible that some people are more hypnotizable than others. As I mentioned in the book, I did it professionally for a while at a clinic for 7 years, actually, hypnosis. And some people are they go right under, and other people it takes much longer, and you have to use a slightly different, more indirect method with it. And, you know, you and I are both Geminis, and the mind is always active. And yes. I think that makes it a bit harder, you know, to kind of get into that, you know, deeper level. But I think if you had the right person to do it, you could do it.
Well, Don Klein thought I was very hypnotizable. He said, you know, Whitley, you've been hypnotized a lot. And I said, I've never been hypnotized before in my life. He said, well, that's not what your body is telling me. But after that, I don't think anybody's ever succeeded in putting me under very effectively. I'm very guarded. I don't want to go under now. There was one I tried about 4 or 5 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I guess. And she's a very renowned hypnotist, and it did not work. I just fell asleep. I tried back when we lived in Texas. There was a lady who was a psychologist and a hypnotist, and was a good friend, very comfortable. She couldn't put me under for love or money. Don Klein, it took him maybe a minute to get me well under, very deep. Not never since. Like it's been turned off.
And yet it seems as though the visitors, if that's what's going on here, have an ability to do it with you. Or
well,
no.
Someone does, and I'm not so sure it's the visitors. The reason being that in 2019, I believe in June of 2019, I was briefly in the company of some people who knew some very deep secrets about Roswell. And on my way home, when I landed at LAX, I ended up right in the middle of the airport getting missing time for 45 minutes. And that couldn't have been done by Grays. I mean, someone surely would have seen them. Aliens, I mean. It must have been done by people.
Huh.
So, okay, well, let's not belabor that. Let's go on. And I'm looking at my copious notes here. I want to ask you, let's go back to kind of the beginnings. And because this lovely book is a journey through a very remarkable life, folks. And so let's go back to the very beginning. And I'm going to ask you a question based around your experiences with Goswami and Shelley. What's his last name?
Shelley Trimmer.
Trimmer. Yeah, I can't read my own handwriting. And ask you what a mystic is. You're a mystic, I think.
Well, I'm a backsliding mystic. I don't put myself in that category. Really, I don't. I think having had a couple mystical experiences or in your life doesn't necessarily make you a mystic. But the way I would, you know, describe a mystic is someone who is a psychonaut in a sense. Someone that is not only involved with exploring consciousness, but mastering the mind and the body, and coming to a deeper understanding of identity, of who or what we are. That, in a nutshell, is how I describe it. And I've had certain glimpses of things, but I wouldn't put myself on the same level as these teachers. I've been very lucky to have some great teachers. And
yes.
Those two, plus the Zen teacher, Daido. And so does that answer your question?
To a degree, I would like to go a little bit deeper. When you describe the afterlife, and by the way, I am speaking of lives. I had a very busy night last night with the visitors and whoever wakes me up in the middle of the night. I don't know if you know about this about me, but my listeners do. I'm generally waked up about 3 o'clock in the morning to meditate. And this morning I woke up about 1:30 on my own and did it. Unfortunately, I did it at the wrong time and was waked up again at 4 by whoever comes in and wakes me up. And so I'm beat today, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to enjoy this show. I'm looking forward to more. Now, you go into the you say something fascinating about the afterlife, that it's a semi-dream state. What do you mean by that? Because it resonated with me. Some people I've seen in the afterlife are like dreamers. And yeah. What about, you know, if we don't necessarily want to dream our afterlife, what do we need to do to prepare? So first tell us about it, and then give us some ideas from your experience about how we should prepare.
I'm going by what I've learned from different teachers on this. I don't think a lot of awareness on that level, but what I've learned is that the afterlife state eventually becomes kind of like a dream state. It's not fully aware. It's similar to what we have at nighttime. And there are moments of clarity, lucid dreams, like in lucid dreams, you suddenly become aware. And from what I understand, that happens in the afterlife. But eventually we kind of run into, we move into a state of semi-consciousness and be into the rebirth state. But what I've also learned is that to heighten that awareness in the afterlife requires a concerted effort in the waking, in our ordinary life, of meditation, of trying to become as aware as possible, so that when the death comes, it's not a rupturing. There's like a continuous stream of consciousness into the afterlife state. And one of the ways of preparing for that is to fall asleep slowly, to try to, as on a nightly basis, the practice of dying every night you go to sleep, of trying to sustain awareness over into the dream state. And the more you can do that, the more you'll sustain awareness at the death point into the astral state. That's the best I understand with it.
It's very interesting because, of course, this business of this sensing exercise that I've been doing for so much of my life, and the visitors turned out to be incredibly interested in it. I learned it in the Gurdjieff Foundation in 1969, and have been doing it regularly ever since. And interestingly enough, after Annie died, that's when I started to be waked up by somebody in that time. And she never did it. She said, I don't need to do it because I always am like that, always with the separated attention. And she wasn't kidding. So I think it's her trying to make sure that I don't fall into that dream state after my body is finished, because she's not in it and she does not want me to be in it either. That's what I think this is all about.
Well, can I add something there? Because when I read your book, New World, I was fascinated by the experience you had in South Dakota, in terms of, it seemed like you were picking up on the etheric level of phenomena. And it really does seem, from everything I've read and from stories like yours, that the visitors, whatever they are, whoever they are, have this ability to move between those two realms, between the physical and the etheric. And that's why you have stories like in that marvelous film, Witness of Another World, where the person who had the experience saw, I think it was his deceased father, on the craft. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
Tell us.
From what I remember, in the movie I recommended, A Witness of Another World, I think it's on Amazon Prime. And it was, I think it might have been Guatemala or Ecuador, where this man described an experience where it was a quote-unquote alien encounter, a third close encounter of the third kind. And when he went into the craft or approached the craft, he saw a deceased figure with the visitor. And you hear these stories quite a bit of people that have these phenomenal experiences where there are deceased individuals that they've known in the past in the arena of the phenomena, which suggests that there is some otherworldly quality and interdimensional quality to these experiences.
Absolutely. That is the, I thought that was the great insight of that Anne had when she came out of her office that day and said, Whitley, this has something to do with what we call death. And she then became an expert on the afterlife and its relationship to the visitor experience, proceeded to have a near-death experience, became an expert on near-death experiences. And when she died with a very thoroughgoing awareness and understanding of what would happen, and built our relationship as it is now after she died from the other side. So this is very possible, all of this, and yeah, it's very real. And one of the things that happens to most people is we just drift along. We kind of live waiting for something to happen. We're very passive. And you're not. And there's something fundamentally not passive about your whole life experience. And I want to illustrate that, if you'll tell us about what happened to the bowl on the dining room table. Oh, this is just a classic Ray Grass approach to life.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I was maybe about 12. And I had seen something on TV about an opera singer breaking glass with her voice. And I wanted to check this out for myself. So I sat in one room of the house and I focused my attention on the dining room table, which was maybe 10 feet away, something like that, 12 feet. And I started to do a high pitched sound, ee, like that. And I focused on that bowl and I kept focusing, and suddenly the bowl shattered all over the table. And my mother comes running in because she heard all the glass. And this was a crystal bowl. It was not a, you know, it wasn't some little thin bowl. And she said, "What happened?" And I told her, and she didn't quite believe it, but it is what happened. And I've never been able to replicate it. But the point is that, you know, it's always intrigued me ever since that happened, because how could I have done that from 12 feet away just with the sound? Because I've since found out, since I wrote the book, in fact, that there actually are instances where an opera singer or someone with a certain pitch voice can break a wine glass, a certain kind of wine glass. But that is not quite the same as what I experienced. This was not a wine glass, and I was quite a distance away from this bowl. So that was one of the crazy little things I did as a kid back.
And there's something wrong with it, and you just summed it up. It probably was impossible, and yet it happened. It's one thing, as you say, to break a wine glass with a practiced voice that can reach a certain tone. Another thing entirely, when a 12-year-old boy does it, have you ever had any other psychokinetic experiences in your life?
Not that I can recall. I've had plenty of psychic experiences and paranormal experiences. I'm trying to think if I've had anything. I probably have, and I can't recall right now, but I've had plenty of paranormal or psychic experiences along the way, and maybe things where I thought something and then it came to pass, but not in the same way that I did with that crystal bowl.
Yeah, so you had that that happen, but it would have changed you internally.
Yeah.
And it did. Tell us what you thought afterwards, because it began. This is an important point, because this is when your life, in a sense, began to open up. You'd had this happen to you, and you knew it had happened. So go ahead and
first
tell us
of all, that. I grew up in the '60s, and there was a lot of this in the air, and I think that's an important point. When I grew up, there were TV shows like One Step Beyond and Twilight Zone and Star Trek, and then the Beatles would come on the Johnny Carson show to talk about transcendental meditation. So you had a lot of this in the atmosphere at the time. And I had a series of experiences of which that crystal bowl was one, and they slowly changed my perception. One of those that I mentioned in the introduction was a lucid dream where I became aware in the dream state that I was dreaming. And it was astonishing because I could see every blade of, I was in my family's backyard, and I could see every blade of grass. And I remember stomping down on the grass. I said, I can feel this. This is not a dreamy Hollywood type of foggy experience. And that was maybe the most astonishing of all the experiences I had, along with the crystal bowl and the ghost encounters and the UFO encounters and all this, because it showed me that there really wasn't that much of a difference between the dream state and the waking state. And so my first book was called The Waking Dream, which was about, you know, the synchronistic and symbolic dimensions of experience. And so all of those things combined to kind of make me who I am in terms of the belief system that I now have.
Anne used to wonder whether or not we were the dead, that this was the world of the dead, and we were all of us in denial. We were denying our reality. And when we, quote unquote, died, we would be born into real life. How do you respond to that thought?
Well, that's certainly what Gurdjieff and other teachers would say.
Yeah, have and you had much experience with the Gurdjieff work?
Just a little bit. I was so heavily into the yogic, Kriya Yoga in particular, and Tibetan to some extent, that I didn't get as much into the Gurdjieff. But they're all, and the Zen I was involved with too later on, and they're all, there's a similarity between all of them. It's, there isn't nearly as much difference. And I got a kick out of the fact that some of the teachers I encountered in the yogic tradition looked down their noses at, let's say, Buddhism, and some of the Buddhists I encountered looked down their noses at the yogic practitioners. And when you really get into the heart of the practices, they're basically the core practices and belief systems are similar.
Yeah, that's why they look down at each other, because they don't want to lose their students.
And also because in some cases they haven't studied the other traditions deeply enough to know that of the similarities. And I saw that, where you saw people that, and I was that way myself before I got into Zen Buddhism, for example. I kind of myself looked down my nose at it. And then when I get into it and I discovered that there wasn't that much of a difference. What was your question again? I think I lost my thread there.
Oh, well, it was a rhetorical question just designed to spark the conversation about whether or not this is the world of the dead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My personal belief is that we actually have more awareness in this world than we do on the other side, but there is a temporary expansion of awareness when we cross over of this almost cosmic consciousness. I can't prove that. That's just my personal belief based on things I've, you know, been taught. But I do think compared to the way a mystic, a true mystic or a avatar, for example, might experience reality, we are asleep, and I can't get around that. We're all basically asleep here compared to where we could be.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And my entire adult life has been very much about waking up while in this life. Now, let's talk a little bit about...
Excuse me, can I add something there that I think is important?
Sure, of course, yes.
A lot of people who haven't had that waking up experience through conventional means have maybe experienced it through psychedelics, for instance, where they might do, you know, ayahuasca, they might do LSD and experience those heightened states. And some people do it naturally through things like holotropic breathing. Because when you take those deep breaths through certain practices, you experience that heightened awareness. But what I certainly believe, based on the teachers I've studied with, is that you don't need those artificial props I don't think breathing is artificial, technically speaking, but I don't think we need those artificial props to experience it, because I have had certain experiences in meditation.
Right.
Without anything like deep breathing or LSD or ayahuasca. So I don't think those are necessary, but I think some people have tasted that higher awareness in those, you know, indirect ways, perhaps.
Now, you have had some powerful LSD experiences, and Free Dreamlanders are going to take a brief break here for some commercials. And when we come back, we will be talking once again to Ray Grass. His book, The sky stretched out before me. We'll be right back. We're talking to Ray Grass. The sky stretched out before me. Ray, do you have an active website?
Yeah, raygrassi.com, RayGrasse.com. My photography site is raygrassephotography.com.
I'll have to remember to pronounce your name correctly. You're very polite not to.
Well, any way you want to pronounce it is fine by me, really.
It's like Strieber Stryber. I get both, and I've long since given up worrying
about it. Right, me too.
Yeah, thank you. All right, now let's go back to your early life and your experiences with LSD.
What I had, I did LSD maybe 15 times or so in my 20s.
Uh-huh.
And have not done it for 35 years, maybe more. Probably 40 years. And it was a mixed bag in the sense of it definitely, the thing that I found fascinating about it was the way it sheared off the conceptual labels that we bring to experience in a way where you tend to experience things as they are, more as they are, I should say. Similar to what I had in certain states of meditation. What I didn't like about the LSD was being out of control. And what I mean by that, it's kind of like you're in a car and there may be a wise guru driving the car or sometimes a madman, but you're not the one steering the steering wheel. And it might be an extraordinary experience, but it's very hard to have control over where your mind is going in those states of psychedelic awareness. So that's why I stopped doing it. I'm not against it. I don't mind if other people do it. It's just that I don't, it's a little too much for me now. It's a little too chaotic in terms of being that sense of being out of control. But I think for some people, I think it's a very useful tool if it's done under the right circumstances.
Yeah, well, perhaps so. Personally, I've never done any drugs at all, and not marijuana, LSD, anything. I've had ample evidence in my own life that that would not be a good idea. Let me put it that way. So one of the doctors who has studied my brain said, "You don't really need to add LSD to your very complicated brain. You need to leave that alone." And I do have a cousin who had a bad LSD trip from which he never recovered in his life and still is struggling with it 50 years later. So now,
I think that when you're talking about someone like yourself or myself who tend to have a life of the mind more so.
Yeah, a very imagistic life of the mind.
Yes, I think it's a little riskier to dabble with those things, with the psychedelics, only because it's very easy to get ungrounded. And that's another reason why, that's kind of what I was saying before in a different way. I think that for someone who is really grounded, it's a different thing, I think, to experiment with those psychedelics. But I'm already very into my mind, and so the LSD, I think, amplified that even more, which is good in some ways but problematic in others.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I think that it's not always, and ayahuasca and so forth are not always bad experiences for people, but they can be, and especially for certain people. Now, I want to move on to you have had a whole lifetime of odd sort of little experiences, just like I have,
yeah,
that don't add up, but are filled with all kinds of implications. For example, you're living in a little house with your wife, a little tiny house from the measurements you include in the book. And one night, it's all locked up, and what happens? Somebody walks in.
Yeah, I was lying on the bed. We had a little futon in the middle of the floor. It was like a cabin. This is back in the 90s. And I was not asleep. I couldn't fall asleep. And I was having trouble just, you know, falling asleep. And I suddenly hear in the darkened room footsteps, clomp, 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 sort of footsteps walking from the back of the house, which is maybe just 5 feet away, the bathroom, towards the edge of the bed where my face was. And it scared me to death because I thought to myself, how did a stranger get in the house and what's going to happen next? Because I thought that this person was now standing over me. And I thought, you know, maybe they don't have my best intentions.
Yeah, that would be a logical conclusion.
And it was very loud. It was not soft. And I was wide awake at the time. And I laid there. I played dead. I played, you know, like I was asleep. I didn't want to provoke any alarm on the part of this intruder. And I laid there for maybe 15, 20 minutes and nothing else happened. And I finally opened my eyes and there was no one there. I got up and I thought, well, I don't know how they got around the futon. It was blocking the way there. And I went and checked the only door into the small cabin. And it was locked. There was no way someone could get in. And my wife at the time, she said that she had similar experiences. There was a fellow that had lived in the house years before that used to wear these big, heavy boots, lived by himself in the house. And she said that she would sometimes hear his footsteps through the house. And that was very frightening. But I've had a number of things like that, like the time when I was maybe 13, living in my parents' home in Oak Park, Illinois. And I was upstairs in my bedroom, and I heard, again, footsteps coming up the maybe 13, 14 steps coming up the stairs to the second floor of the house, expecting one of my parents to walk in the room, and nothing happened. And it was clear as day, the sound. And I go to the door, and there's no one there. And I went downstairs. No one else was in the house at the time. And I've had a number of these things happen where, from a young age, where it's hard to believe that this world is all there is to it when you have enough of those experiences and you try to rationalize them away. But at some point, you just have to give up the rationalizations and realize there's more going on here than meets the eye.
Yeah, I once had a sort of message in, and I'm this is totally out of context because I just when you said that, I remembered these words. This is your life. Live it. And someone said that to me. I don't know if it was a person or it came from some other level or it's totally out of context, but I just remember hearing those words and they're very germane to this because you've got to open yourself up to this life, which you did. You did. There was a certain point where you began to think to yourself, well, you know, this is my life. I better go for it and see what I can make of it.
Sometimes you open yourself up to life and sometimes life opens you up.
Tell us.
And it's an interesting dance between the two because you hear stories all the time about someone. Oh, like, for example, I just recently related this story on social media. I knew a young woman that a very smart woman. Her father was a professor. Mother was a journalist. And we got to talking about paranormal things as part of, we talked about many things, but when we got to the paranormal, she didn't believe any of that. She was a skeptic. And then I didn't talk to her for many years. She lived in Norway, where I had family living as well. And years later, we hooked up and we got to talking about these things. And she said, you know, a funny thing happened to me a few years ago. She was at her parents' condo by the kitchen window, working and washing the dishes, I guess. And she looked out the window, and every day she would see this man who lived in the complex walking his dog around the lake in the middle of the condo complex. This was in Oslo. And one day, the dog eventually died, and the man would go off and walk by himself around the lake. One day she looks out the window, and she sees the man walking around the lake with the phantom image of her deceased dog prancing around the man. The man apparently didn't see this. And this was a shock to her because she wasn't predisposed to believe in this sort of thing. And that's what made the story so compelling to me. The fact that she wasn't looking for this. She didn't even believe in this sort of thing happening. Life kind of pried open with a crowbar her skepticism to show her a different glimpse of what's really going on.
It's interesting that the dog was prancing around her, because was the dog trying to attract her attention?
Well, it was the man. The man. It was prancing around the man.
I'm sorry. Was the dog trying to attract his attention and failing? I can't forget one of the first things Anne said after she died is, "It looks like you're all intentionally ignoring us." Are we? Do you think?
Interesting. I don't know the answer to that.
No, I don't either. But the dog does.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of that. Was the dog trying to get the man's attention? Because my friend said that she didn't think that the man could see the dog, because he just was looking ahead and doing his normal walk. And she was the one that saw it, but the man didn't. You know, in fact, someone asked me recently the question. They said, do you need to be in a certain kind of altered state, a natural altered state, perhaps, to see these things? And yet sometimes you can photograph these phenomena.
Tell us.
Is the camera in an altered state? I don't think so. It's, in other words, sometimes the phenomena is so powerful that it impinges itself through into physical reality. And other times it's where you'll have a group of people and one might see the phenomena, but the others don't. In which case, I think it's that person's, they're attuned to something different than the other people with the group.
The camera's going to see everything that is there in the sense that anything that is reflecting light properly, the camera will see. But we only see what we want to see and what we can see. I've known many situations where one person is seeing a UFO and another person right beside him doesn't see it. And then, of course, the one who didn't see it thinks the one who saw it's gone crazy, et cetera, and so forth. And in fact, I can't be specific, but I remember a case where a husband and wife, this is probably in one of the letters we got years ago, the wife saw a UFO out the kitchen window. And the husband looked and couldn't see it and laughed at her. And then he went out a little later. It was in the evening and he saw it too. And she came rushing out. And when he could see it, she couldn't. So that's the kind of thing. And you have to wonder, the visitors in my experience can get very jokey, and you know, they may have been sort of joking around with them because they realized the husband couldn't see it first. And then they made sure that when he could see it, she couldn't. Or maybe it just was life, the way the body is. I don't know.
You hear this a lot with the Skinwalker Ranch, where why is it some people go there and they have all these experiences and other people spend a great deal of time out there and don't experience anything at all?
Yeah. Well, I'm not invited to the Skinwalker Ranch, but Linda Moldenhau has been. And I don't think she had any anomalous experiences there. But other people I know have many such experiences at the Skinwalker Ranch dating back for years. Now, you know, I want to be sure you recall this on page 53 of the book, you specifically mentioned that you were knew a Roswell eyewitness, but you don't say anything more about it than that.
Oh, yeah. Back when I was at a Buddhist monastery in upstate New York, I got to know a fellow who said his uncle—I think it was his uncle—had been been stationed at Roswell in 1947, and he told a story of being sent out in the middle of the night to pick up body parts from a wreckage of a craft. And his commander was Colonel Blanchard, which is a famous name in the story, red-haired fellow. And He was told never to talk about this again, him and the other two paramedics that were sent out in a medic truck, I guess, in the middle of the night to the desert. And there's an interesting twist to this story because he was Jewish and his name was Tiny Fortman. His nickname was Tiny Fortman. I forget his first name. His nickname was Tiny. And he described that he got to the Roswell base later than July of 47. And he said this happened between Christmas and New Year's.
Wow. So that suggests there was more than one event.
And what he said that was very interesting, he said when they brought him and his fellow paramedics back to the base, he said the way they, the kind of the spiel they did to the soldiers sounded like they had been through this before. It was like well rehearsed and it wasn't like this was an unusual event. Now, anyway, I got in touch with, Stanton Friedman got in touch with me about this because he had heard about it through Tom Stultz, who was a MUFON, the head of Illinois MUFON back in the early 90s. And so Stanton, I gave him the information. He got in touch with Tiny Fortman, went out and interviewed him. And he said he's legit. He's not lying, but he didn't want to publish it until he got a backup witness, someone else that could verify it. He put it in his famous gray box. But he found Tiny Fortman quite credible and found it a fascinating story because it was a different Roswell event than the famous one of July.
Yes.
So to this day, it remains an unanswered question. This, you can find the story online if you type in my name. For the website dailygrail.com, I wrote up a story about this. And if you type in Roswell and my name, you'll come up with the story where I interviewed him. I interviewed Fortman and I printed up the transcript of the talk. And it was a fascinating story because, again, he didn't believe any of this stuff. And the other thing that's curious about it was, he wound up being in a, he left the service, he wound up being in a traveling band with Jim Lorenzen, who you probably know the name.
Yes, of course.
Jim and Carol Lorenzen of APRO, I think it was.
Right.
And he never said a word to Jim about his experience. During the time that they were in a traveling jazz band, I guess Fortman played the saxophone. I forget what Jim played. But all the years that he knew Jim Lorenzen, he didn't say a word to him about it because he was so scared of the threats that had been lodged against him by, it was either Colonel Blanchard or one of the other, you know, commanders there at the base. But he described picking up these bodies in the middle of the night. He said there was a ring of top brass around, floodlights on the pieces of the craft and the bodies. And he said that it wasn't explained to him what these things were. They were simply told, pick up these body parts and put them in body bags. And he said, as he's looking at these things, he realized these weren't human. They were smaller. They weren't conventional grays. He said they were more like, you know, he said they looked oriental and they had different number. I don't know if it was four fingers or six fingers, whatever it was. Now, mind you, I'm not claiming anything about what the story was. Perhaps this was some kind of a staged op of some sort. We don't know what happened. So I don't know what Tiny experienced or what the reality of it was. I do know, I do believe he was sincere in what he described.
Yes.
But what he actually saw, I don't know.
Well, that's well said, because it's, you know, it's very hard to tell when you're dealing with something as strange as this, exactly what you're seeing. And he probably described what he believed he was seeing very accurately. And it troubled me a good deal, because I've always felt that there was so much more to that story and the other stories, and the so much more that's so deeply hidden involves hostility between us and them, whoever they are. And I was thinking when I didn't know this would come up because you just mentioned it so briefly and I hadn't read the Daily Grail piece. So now I think to myself, what if we were in a shooting war with them? And this is what you were witnessing was something that was brought down by us. What might that mean for the rest of us and for our world? If I just don't know anything. I don't know whether you have any sense of anything like that. I don't see why you would. I don't.
Well, I've thought about it.
It's very worrisome. Yeah, of course.
I don't know what it was. It could have been like some people. I don't know if it was who said it. It might have been you that some people have theorized these things were planted there as part of a acculturation process or some sort of education, you know. So I entertain all the possibilities, but I just don't know.
That was Diana Pasulka in American Cosmic who theorized that.
Yeah.
And that's because there's a site known as the donation site.
Donation, that's it.
Yeah, that's in New Mexico. It's not near Roswell. But that this site has been a source of materials for many, many years. People go out some people have a knack of collecting materials there, and they can go out and just sift through the earth, and sooner enough they'll find something, and other people can't find anything. And this thing has been combed for materials for years and years,
yeah.
And yet there always seem to be a few more.
Yes,
that's why it's called the donation site.
Yeah.
So now let's go on because you weren't really. You were at a meeting with a young man. With a book of full of elaborate drawings of different alien species.
Right.
Can you tell us about that and about what happened afterwards?
Yeah. Tom Stultz, the fellow I mentioned who was the Illinois head of MUFON. This is around 1990-91. He would have monthly groups at his home in Downers Grove, Illinois. And one of those meetings, like one time he had me go out with them to investigate a crop circle that had been found in outside of Argonne National Laboratory. It was 6 inches of ice water there. We trudged through it and we found what seemed to be in the middle of nowhere, a crop circle that was maybe the first one. Tom claimed it was the first one that had really been found in North America. But again, there's a history here, so I don't frankly know if that's entirely true. But on another occasion, he said he was inviting a young man to his monthly meeting. He was maybe 25, 26, and he seemed very knowledgeable on this subject. He had a notebook full of drawings of different alien species, and I didn't know what to make of it. I still don't know what to make of it. And I frankly was a little skeptical because it was so far out. And they had a group meeting this one night where he said that he would be in contact with the intelligences that are above Earth in some fashion, and that we could ask questions, and he would now call it channel answers. And I went there with my wife, Judith, and we were quite skeptical. And after we left that night, the one thing Judith said to the young man, somewhat skeptically, if you're really there, whoever you are, the visitors, give us a sign, show us some sort of indication that you're real, that this isn't just, you know, hogwash. And the answer from the young man was, we'll give you a sign sometime tonight. So when we left the house that night and drove back home, we kind of dismissed the whole thing. It just seemed too far out. And that night when we went to bed, I fell asleep very quickly, and I went out like a light, which isn't like me. And she was still awake. I think she was sitting on the edge of the bed. I don't remember the exact details. And she said, suddenly a ball of light came through the window, it was maybe the size of a grapefruit, came floating through the window and exploded in front of her noiselessly, totally freaked her out. And yet she saw no reason to wake me up, which is very odd.
Very odd.
Yeah. And then herself sat there for a short while and then went to sleep herself and then brought it up the next morning. And I couldn't believe that, you know, I had slept through it. I couldn't believe she didn't say anything to me. And then so she called up Tom Stultz to mention this extraordinary experience that she had. And before she told Tom what had happened, he said something like, so you saw the ball of light or something like that. He seemed to know in advance what her experience had been, which freaked us both out a little bit. And to this day, I don't know what to make of it. And in the book, I make an oblique reference to the fact that it almost was like a seance, the gathering of people. It's almost like an incantation, an invocation that we were doing. So again, I'm not saying we contacted aliens in a spaceship. It could have been anything. It could have been we drew down some other intelligences or forces. I have an open mind about it. I don't know what happened, but it certainly was unusual. The whole evening was unusual.
Well, you know, there's a very interesting sort of hidden arc in this conversation that now sort of comes to the surface. We talked earlier about Kenneth Anger and his magical abilities to alter a person's, to induce missing time in someone. And now we're talking about the possibility that the dead, our own dead, or some other aspect of consciousness entirely might be involved in this. And maybe the idea of thinking of it in terms of Earth, human beings and aliens isn't really accurate enough, or I should say complete enough to be all that useful. And so it's so fascinating that you would be at a meeting with a man who had a total commitment to the alien hypothesis. Obviously, he wouldn't have had those all those drawings in a notebook. And then afterwards, what happens is your wife proceeds to have an experience that kind of flies in the face of that assumption completely. It's really, the whole thing is fascinating. There's something here, Ray, and I can't put my finger on it exactly, but it's something in part about you and her and the way your beings kind of interface with the real, with the world. And well,
Tell a story? I don't think I've ever told this publicly before, but I almost put it in the book and I didn't. But when I was 16 or 15, going to high school, a close friend of mine died of spinal meningitis. And I then went, about a week or two later, I went to Norway, where I went to visit some family in an old house outside of Oslo. And maybe a 150-year-old home with probably quite a history to it. And I was in the upstairs bedroom, and I was grieving over the loss of this friend, and I wanted to contact him wherever he was to kind of see if I could manifest him in some sense, to see if he was all right. And I laid awake with the lights on in the room. There was like a hanging of a chandelier in the top of the room. And I said, move the chandelier, do something to show me that you're here. And I, for a solid hour, maybe an hour and a half, I was sending this message out to show me a sign that you're there, Harmon. Harmon was his name. And nothing happened after about an hour and a half. And so I finally went to sleep. And then I woke up around 2 or 3 hours later in the pitch dark room. My eyes were wide open, fixed at the foot of my bed, and there was a phantom figure. And it scared me to death because I didn't make any connection at that point to what I had done 2 hours earlier. I didn't put the two together. And I thought, what the hell? And I rubbed my eyes because I said, maybe this is just something in my eyes. And it became even clearer. At which point, then I was really, freaked out. So I rolled over in true cowardly fashion, buried my face in the pillow and just tried to forget about this until the sun came up. And then it was only when I woke up in the morning that I thought, geez, I wonder if that was Harmon, because I couldn't make out the features. It was just, it was clearly a human form at the foot of my bed. And maybe if I had looked at it more closely, I would have seen, facial features, but I didn't. And again, it's the thing, I jokingly refer to that as experiments in necromancy, but it was really a sense of calling up that force. And I thought of that actually when I had that experience at Tom Stoltz's home, because of the way we were sitting around in a circle and the young man was in the middle. And it had that quality to it of invoking something, whatever that something might have been.
So it's, we're really living now or talking on the shadow line that I live on. And I think more of us should, because we've talked about
an obvious physical alien experience that the witness, the Roswell witness, was aware of. And we're talking now about phantoms. And somehow or another, and we've just been talking about magic, I think we're all talking about everything we're talking about is part of the same thing.
Yeah.
And it leads me to a question. And then after this, we're going to go on with our subscribers and we're going to open a whole new door, because there's a lot of doors in Ray Gracie,
yes.
Many doors. And that's going to be a door into astrology and the present moment and the future of Earth. But right now, where are you with this mysterious juxtaposition of the sort of phantom and the real? In other words, body parts in Roswell, footsteps in your house that make no sense, a phantom standing at the foot of the bed, who you realize later is a response to a request. What's going on?
To right? me, this
give
all
us a,
ties
give us a
in.
quick explanation of right. the nature
yeah.
of reality.
Good luck. To me, it all ties into synchronicity and symbolism, and I have a chapter in the book about the synchronistic dimensions of these sorts of things, that they don't happen by accident, and they don't happen. They happen at times that are powerful transition points in our life. So that when I had that experience of the phantom in the bedroom, or the footsteps, or the UFOs that I've seen, for instance, right. whatever they are, they've happened at powerful transition points, turning points in my life. And you can see this, for example, in a person's horoscope, like the person I know that was driving along Highway 1 with his family. And he saw a light off over the ocean, and it suddenly darted off. And it was a shocking sort of realization, because he had never thought about these things before. And I looked at his horoscope at the time that this happened, and it was a powerful turning point in his horoscope. And there's this fluid relationship, I think, between consciousness and your outer reality. And I think that it's a give and take sort of thing. And, so synchronicity for me is one of the keys to this, as far as understanding what is the meaning of this experience at this time in my life. And I don't want to get too much into do we create our reality, because I think that's a very complicated question. But in general, to me, it's all symbolic. Your waking life is like your dream life, in the sense that there is a symbolic dimension, that the outer reflects the inner, as above, so below. All of those things tie together. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
No, you can't answer the question's unanswerable, but your response to it is beautiful. No, it's I think that you're touching a lot of points here, which are really very important. And that is that to sum it up, since we're about to finish the first hour of the show, that there is a level of ambiguity, a kind of shadow line between the physical and non-physical worlds. And the physical aspect of the close encounter experience, or the UFO experience, literally lies right on that shadow line. Those bodies were there, but they didn't mean quite the same thing, maybe, that bodies that are more invested in physical reality mean, because at least my experience of visitors is that they have the ability to, or that they live, the ones that are physical live in this world, yes, but they are also much more directly aware and reacting to their own presence in other levels of reality at the same time, which is what makes them so strange to us. Ray Grass's book is The Sky Stretched Out Before Me, and it's a perfect title for this wonderful, expansive, enjoyable wisdom journey through a remarkable life. I commend it to you, and I'm also remembering his actual pronunciation of his name is Ray Grasset. I will get
there's
it
no
wrong.
Actual pronunciation anymore than there is with you.
I will get it wrong. You can visit him on raygrasset.com. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And you should do so. Ray's got a lot of wisdom. And subscribers, you're about to find out something more about Ray's wisdom as he looks at our world through the eyes of a truly accomplished astrologer. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. All right, Ray, let's talk about first, let's begin with your life in astrology, which has been quite extensive. What drew you to it in the first place?
When I was going to school at the Art Institute of Chicago, I was getting adjunct credits at other colleges in the area to flesh out my academics. So I was going to the University of Chicago, Roosevelt, Columbia College, Adler Planetarium, a bunch of different places. And Columbia College was offering an astrology course, which really was fascinating to me. I was about 21 at the time. And I found out, I did some research into the teacher. Her name was Maureen Cleary. And she had been at the University of Chicago before coming to Columbia College. And before that, she had been a novitiate at a convent in Kentucky, where she knew Thomas Merton, by the way, who was at a monastery down the road. And she was this very brilliant woman, and she was teaching with some of the great intellectuals of that period at the University of Chicago, such as Paul Ricoeur and James Hillman and Mircea Eliade. And in her mid-20s, she was teaching with these brilliant people. And so I knew she was not a lightweight, and I took a course in astrology with her over a couple semesters, and I was utterly blown away by not only by astrology, but by how brilliant she was. And then I wound up studying astrology with several other teachers, including Goswami Kriyananda and Shelley Trimmer and many others, taking many other seminars. And it was, to put it mildly, an eye-opening experience because it changed my view of reality in the same way, well, in a similar way to what happened with those paranormal experiences when I was younger or, you know, the lucid dreaming experience I had. It showed me there was a design, an order to our lives, that it wasn't haphazard, that a person comes in with a certain birth horoscope, and that their life unfolds in certain archetypal ways. It's not a precise sort of, you can't look at a person's horoscope and tell that they're going to be 6'1" and that they're going to, be a certain, have a very precise interest or use a certain toothpaste. It's not like that. It gives you the archetypal contours of someone's life. And then you've got the what we call the transit and progression side of astrology, which is where you can track the planets going through a person's entire life and see the patterns that come up, like I hinted at before, when a person has a dramatic experience. It's usually when there are some very powerful planets triggering their horoscope. And from there, I wound up just getting deeper and deeper into it, and I wound up studying how it applies to the culture as well. What is called mundane astrology. It's based on the old term mundus for world, you know, the Latin term.
Yes.
So you can actually look at what's happening, and this kind of segues to where I think you're going with this. It gives you a clue to what's happening in the culture, because you see certain patterns come up in the culture, like the JFK assassination or 9/11, or the Beatles might hit it big, and all sorts of things, positive and negative, that happen on the global scale. And you can read it in certain ways that give you insight into what these things mean. And we've been through a lot the last few years, to anyone that's been paying attention.
Yeah, we sure have. And we're going through a lot now. And we have in the United States a vast number of people who are terribly dissatisfied and frightened of for example, they're frightened of the vaccine. they're dissatisfied with the government, with their lives. The conspiracy theories are running rampant. All kinds of things that are not really supportable rationally. And it always worries me because the visitors said that we would go crazy when we began to realize our planet was in deep trouble. And I that's what I see. And what I want, and in the world around us, we have massive out of control fires in the Arctic, flood after flood, a terrible hurricane just a few days ago in the American Gulf Coast, in an area that is going to be so pummeled by storms over the next few years that it's going to become unlivable. And so where are we, Ray, astrologically? I guess that's a broad question, but I think that that's a good place to start.
I can answer that on a micro level and a macro level. The micro level is there are certain planets that have been churning things up in the sky the last few years. 2020, we knew in advance, for years in advance, that 2020 was going to see a major turbulent shift. We didn't know it was going to be specifically the COVID situation. Some astrologers did actually, did predict a pandemic type situation. I thought it might be an economic crash, which did kind of happen in a way. We knew because of the way Pluto and Saturn came together and Jupiter joined in with the fun in Capricorn, there were things that affected the whole planet. But on top of that, there are things happening, and those are long-term. Every time Pluto and Saturn come together like that, you tend to have long-lasting implications, such as the last time those planets came together was the early 80s, and that was when the AIDS crisis happened and other things. I don't want to get political here, but some other things happened in the early 80s that tie into this. But during this time, we now have the United States is undergoing something called, well, there's several things, the Pluto return. Pluto takes 240-something years to come all the way around to where it was at the birth of something. So Pluto is coming back around to where it was in 1776. And I wrote an article for Mountain Astrologer magazine a few years ago that is, you can find online on astro.com. Type in my name and Pluto return, you'll find it, where I predicted there could be a lot of turbulence in the next few years. The Pluto return actually happens. It comes to a head next year in particular, but it's been building up and it's going to be in effect for quite a few years. And it has to do with like a revolutionary sort of fervor. And I think it's a crisis point for the culture. When you look at the Pluto returns for ancient Rome, for instance, which had two of them in the course of its history, or England, which has had three of them, like during around the time of the Elizabethan era, when that started, when Queen Elizabeth came in, it was both a time of turbulence with the fighting between the Protestants and the Catholics, a lot of civil war kind of energies. But it was also the start of the golden age of the Elizabethan era. It was both good and bad. It's not all one or the other. And so right now we're going through this time of the Pluto, which is also a time when a country has to face its collective shadow, which I said when I wrote the article in 2019, that it might be the U.S. having to face the legacy of slavery, as well as its treatment of minorities, the Native Americans, the blacks, Latinos, etc. And that it could also be a crisis point in terms of facing our neglect of the environment and a number of other things. I won't go through the list of them now. But there is a way in which what's happening right now in America, in particular, the U.S., is an exact reflection of what you would expect with this sort of planetary energy happening. Now, that's the micro level. The macro level gets into something that mundane astrologers call the theory of the great ages. This is something you and I spoke about many years ago when we talked about my book, Signs of the Times. This idea that history can be broken down into these broad roughly 2,000 year stages.
Yes.
And that we're now on the pivot point between two great ages, between the Piscean Age and the Aquarian Age. And a lot of what we see happen, and this happens over centuries of time. This does not happen, like I think some people suggest, in a given year or a given date. It's not that simple. It's like a glacial sort of movement. And the Piscean Age was a very religious age in good and bad ways, both. On the one hand, it gave us the Crusades and the Inquisition. On the other hand, it gave us Meister Eckhart and Hildegard of Bingen and you know, some brilliant mystics, as well as in the Orient, people like Dogen of the Zen tradition. And Rumi of the Sufi tradition. It's not all good or bad. And we're on this transition point now from a religious age to a more secular age. So now we see this battle between the forces of fundamentalism and the forces of secular. What we see happening in Afghanistan, what we see happening in America, is very much a battle between ages, between the arch kind of religious Piscean impulses and the more secular, scientific, rational Aquarian impulses. And it's not a simple sort of transition where one day it changes. It's a tug of war that's going to be happening for quite some time. You can see it all the way back, you know, hundreds of years ago. You see it in the Scopes trial, you know, between, you know, where Darwin and Lincoln were born on the same day. They were Aquarians, and they both ushered in, you might say, Aquarian impulses. You know,
they sure did. That's fascinating. I did not know that.
Yeah. And you see these interesting synchronicities of births, like Heisenberg, the physicist born on the same day as Walt Disney. There's some curious sort of things that happen there.
I'm actually studying Heisenberg right now. Speaking of synchronicities, it surprises me that you would bring him up.
And they both, by the way, had sun conjuncting Uranus like you do, which is somewhat of a pioneering, you know, thinking outside the box energy. Now, so a lot of what we see happening is it's a clash of civilizations. It's a clash of great ages, you might say. The abortion debate is another part of this. And I'm not taking sides here. I'm just talking about the ideologies involved. The pro-life forces are very much the Piscean Age sort of energies. And the pro-choice, you know, secular energies are more so the Aquarian side of the fence. So that's the macro side. And so this is going to go on for quite some time, but it eventually gives way, I think, to this more, you know, scientific sort of secular sort of thing. But you never completely lose the impulse of the old age. It's like the Jewish tradition, for example, is very much an Aries age religion with the symbolism of the ram and the burning bush and fire and all this sort of thing. And a god named I Am, which is, you know, very much the key words, for Aries. And when Christianity came in, which was a Piscean age religion, it didn't wipe out Judaism. It simply, you know, had to reach an alliance with it. It did try to wipe out at times. It did try to wipe out Judaism. Yes, and that's where Hitler, I think, was an example of the dark side of that encroaching. Hitler was a kind of a crossbreed between Pisces and Aquarius. But so we're always going to have the Piscean energies there and the Aries age and the Taurus age. They kind of are there as a subliminal subtext of the new age coming in. So that's one way of answering your question of what's going on. But I'll try to elaborate more if you want to pin me down a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'd like to do this. You mentioned that these Pluto returns took place twice during Roman times. Could you tell us what happened during these Pluto returns? It might give us a little more insight into what's going to happen to us.
The common thing, the common thread that you see both in Rome and England, each time there was a Pluto return, was like a cultural upheaval. And where you saw competing forces trying to take over, you know, the empire, or trying to, you know, well, it's even clearer in the case of England with its three Pluto returns, like Protestants and the Catholics, that sense of civil war energies. And in the article I wrote back in 2019 for Mountain Astrologer, one of the things I said we're going to be seeing in America in the coming years was the possibility of civil war. I didn't honestly believe it would lead to, let's say, gunfire or bombs or things like that, or something similar to the Civil War in the 1860s. But now I'm not so sure. I'm looking at it and I'm seeing some of the statements that have even been made in the last few days by certain politicians who are, and certain media personalities that seem to be basically calling for violence on the streets and things like that. So I think that the Pluto return, it's this struggle again. Well, in Rome, like I said, you had deposing of emperors. You had emperors being killed and new emperors taken over. And, you know, it was quite violent. I don't think it's necessarily going to be that way this time. But during the second Pluto return for England, for example, there were assassination attempts on Queen Elizabeth the First.
Yeah, many.
But it also was the period that gave birth to like John Dee and Shakespeare and all that. So I have to keep coming back to the fact that this is a double-edged sword. And this could be a rebirth for America in some very profound way. The thing we have now that has never existed before is the possibility of environmental collapse. You know, it could be an end game situation if we don't get it together and start facing up to this with the pollution and all this. And it's, you know,
it's very serious. A Pluto return means an upheaval. And we have two things kind of intersecting right now in our world. On the one hand, what you just mentioned, this environmental catastrophe that seems to be already spinning out of control, as far as I can tell. And on the other hand, there are increasing suggestions that this mysterious presence that left body parts outside of Roswell and still is very present with us and is in my life, certainly, and in the lives of many people, is about to somehow become more concrete. In other words, there could be, I just sense this, and there's certain whisperings here and there that it might be going to happen, that it could manifest, you could suddenly find these entities people would think of as aliens present among us in some way, however, but convincingly so on a secular level. How do you respond to those thoughts?
You know, it's funny because when we spoke about this many, many years ago, one of the things I said was there's not just Pluto returns, there's several planetary returns, and the Uranus return is another major factor, and that one's coming up in around 2030, 2031, 2032. And the last Uranus return, Uranus is very technological. And the last Uranus return was July of 1947. And that was within days of the Roswell incident, as well as the Maury Island incident, as well as the first reported men in black situation. And there's something else. Kenneth Arnold, of course, June 24th.
You're right.
And so what I said to you back then, which I'll repeat, is that I feel that there's going to be something happening around 2031 that could be the next level up from Roswell. Now, whether that's going to be open contact, whether that's going to be another major phenomena, I don't know. But I personally feel that, and that's not so far away. I remember when I said it to you that long time ago, it felt like it was way in the future. It's now it's getting very close. Well, it's 10 years from now, and it may be sooner than that. But the fact that those things happened within days and weeks of the last Uranus return back in 1947 leads me to believe that there's going to be something very important happening in around 2031, give or take 12 months on either side.
Interesting, because by that time, I think that the cover-up that has been central to our whole relationship with this unknown phenomenon, the government cover-up, I mean, since the 40s, will probably have been essentially over for quite a while by then. We may not have all of the data that they have gathered, but we will certainly know that there is somebody else here. and that this somebody else has some kind of physical presence. So that's very interesting that you say that. Now, there's a lady I'm probably going to interview on Dreamland pretty soon called Anjali, who has gone out and made a press conference saying that there are aliens, as she calls them, living in a cave in the Mojave Desert, and that she's been there, and that they have asked her to bring a team of individuals, and she apparently has a list of names, to come back and videotape them. Is there anything in the present astrological picture that could suggest something like this, an epical event like that might happen?
I think it's possible. I can't speak to that event specifically, but one of the things about Pluto, and I think it's part of the recent quasi-disclosure that we've seen happening, is that Pluto brings things to the surface that have been buried. Buried secrets come to life, whether that is political secrets, scientific secrets, could be paranormal secrets. I think it's entirely possible that there could be something happening in particular next year that has to do with some sort of disclosure of previously buried phenomena of some sort. So again, I can't speak to that about the Mojave Desert specifically, but it certainly would fit in with the energies taking place now.
Buried secrets, hidden in a cave.
Yeah, and Pluto kind of rules caves. Pluto has to do with caves and buried things underground as well. So I find this fits.
I find this absolutely fascinating because I've long since passed the point where I doubt a good astrologer's effectiveness and a capability. And as I said, and I've said before, you're one of the best astrologers in the world, in my opinion. And you're telling me this, and it's dovetailing with what she's saying in some very unexpected ways, that that it brings up buried secrets. I can't, and of course these entities are living in an underground facility that you reach through a cave. Now, they were underground under our house, under our cabin in upstate New York. We heard them there. You could hear them. It wasn't, you could actually hear the sounds that they were making, the drilling sounds. So they were there. And when they came to the cabin, sometimes they smelled like the forest floor, like they had come up through the rot of the forest floor. And it's a very pungent odor. You don't forget it. And it would fill the whole house, in fact, when they were in there. So is something buried is going to arise, going to come up, and Pluto's energy might be just the energy that discloses this, might it not?
Yeah, it could. And I've done the charts for a number of people who are experiencers, if that's the right word. And it's interesting to me as an astrologer how sometimes these things happen under strong Uranus energies, and sometimes they happen under strong Pluto energies. And there's a difference between the types of experiences in terms of some of the Uranian energies tend to be like the high-tech sort of experiences where the people are exposed to, or it might be like a pilot seeing a spacecraft flying in impossible ways, whereas the Pluto experiences tend to be a bit more traumatic, a bit more emotional and deep, and it has to do with sometimes a lifetime of trying to recover lost time. Or, like, for example, I had an experience, which I haven't talked about, in the early 90s, where I don't know if I've ever had a direct encounter the way some people describe, but I had a very bizarre dream once. I don't want to go into too much detail because it gets graphic, but let's just say I woke up feeling like I had been raped. And it was very palpable where I had been violated. And I had, until that moment, I never felt like I understood maybe what a woman or a man goes through when they describe being raped. But this was a definite sense of violation. And I looked at my horoscope at the time, and it was a strong Pluto energy. And there was definitely something, there was an otherness to it. It wasn't a conventional, like, you know, being ganged up in a prison or something like that. And so, yeah, I think that part of what's going on with the United States right now is not just having to face, and the world to some extent, is to not only face the shadows in our past, whether that be our treatment of the blacks or of the Native Americans or immigrants and all this sort of thing, but also coming to terms with buried secrets of a different sort, of things that have been kept tightly under wraps, because, as you know, the tighter you keep something under wraps, the more it's like pressing down on a spring. You give it more force, so eventually it just blows the lid wide open eventually, and I think that could happen, whether the higher-ups want it to happen or not, whether Lockheed wants it to happen or not, if I can put it
like
won't,
that. They won't want it to happen. They cling to everything. They can't let anything go. They have stifled science and the culture in such fundamental ways that they've really lost the right to be where they are and do what they do, I think. Because you hide something like this, like what happened at Roswell, for a few years, that's very understandable.
It started out as a natural security issue, I think.
Right, of course.
And then metastasized.
And metastasized like a cancer. And now it is a disaster, a human disaster of the first order, because the best minds have never gotten to think about it. Think if Stephen Hawking had been able to think about this, the visitors and their machinery and so forth, what might have come of that? But instead, it's kept hidden behind closed doors and dickered with by people generally who are back there in the hidden world because they can't really make it in the outer world. They can't be a Stephen Hawking. They're just not good enough. The best minds have never gotten a chance, a crack at any of this. Or Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's presently pretty much making an idiot of himself about this, is a brilliant man. He could think very usefully about it. But instead, he's been sent down a pointless sidetrack to nowhere by this monolith that is hidden behind closed doors and that hides with it perhaps the secret of the ages, or many secrets of the ages. Ray, it has been such a pleasure to have you back on the show. I cannot imagine why you haven't been on. And I'm so embarrassed about that, but so glad you're here, because I think that in many ways, what we've just discussed is defining the understanding of the meaning of the Pluto return and its relationship to what's happening in the world of disclosure and so forth is very important stuff. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Ray Grasset, and I'm going to pronounce it this way.
Grassy is fine.
Grassy is raygrassy.com.
That's fine.
The sky stretched out before me and before us all.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.